Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Google was staunchly in Hillary Clinton's corner, helping set up her tech operation, and even, according to researchers, manipulating search suggestions and results in her favor. How will this major corporation adapt to the Trump presidency? Is it true that money heals all wounds? The corporate media has gone into overdrive in the final stages of the battle for Aleppo, launching a propaganda campaign against mass killings and even genocide they say are being carried out by the Syrian army. Are the Western governments and press outlets really the humanitarians they claim to be? Are they telling the truth? Despite international and domestic condemnation, the far-right government led by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu seems determined to push ahead with a law that would legalize Israeli settlements built on private Palestinian land. But first, we turn to Google's lobbying and the Trump transition team. We are joined from San Diego by Dr. Robert Epstein. He is the senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. Welcome back, Dr. Epstein.
Well, thank you, Brian.
Thanks for joining. Fortune magazine wrote in an article earlier this week, Alphabet's Google is racing to hire more conservatives for its lobbying and policy arm, trying to get a foothold in the president-elect Donald Trump's Washington. Google really made perhaps a poor investment in this last election cycle. Give us a sense of what their thinking is now that Trump is the president or the president-elect.
Well, Google is scrambling. They're trying to make the best of a bad situation. What the new article in Fortune failed to note is that Google has Google started to adapt almost the day after the election. A full month ago, Google made sure that Google was represented on Trump's transition team. A man named Joshua Wright is a member of the Trump transition team, and Joshua Wright has been off and on Google's payroll for quite a long time. So Google did not waste any time making sure that they ingratiate themselves with the new administration.
Google put out a job listing seeking, quote, a liaison to conservative, libertarian, and free market groups, close quote. Now, it's not like they've never hired a conservative lobbyist before, but are they looking for a different type of conservative to adapt to the Trump era?
Well, they're actually trying to hire someone who will have a high position in the Google company. And whose job it will be to supervise outreach to the conservative community. So that they've never had. They've always hired lobbyists of all sorts, but they're really taking this extremely seriously. So they're doing what a modern, nimble, for-profit company is going to do. That is, they're trying to figure out how to make sure that, you know, they're able to move forward with the new administration. Now, to put this in perspective, you know, they have had an incredibly close connection with the Obama administration. They helped put Obama into office twice. And since Obama has been in office, you know, there have been more than 220 some odd visits by Google employees to the White House. And a number of people have switched positions between Google and the Obama administration. So they have a very close relationship there. Obviously, they're going to try to do the same if they can with the Trump administration. I think it's going to be tough.
Trump had a meeting with all of the high-tech executives a couple days ago in New York. They all come to Mecca, the new Mecca, also known as Trump Tower, and other valued places that Donald Trump holds meetings. The meeting this time was helped organize by Peter Thiel, who, as one of the president-elect's trusted advisors, is the axis, shows that the axis of political power may be shifting in Silicon Valley. What do you think about that?
Well, yes, I think we have to put this in perspective because actually on Tuesday of this week, Bill Gates got his own private meeting with Donald Trump. Then the next day, about a dozen high-tech leaders met with him at the same time without Bill Gates. And yes, this was organized in part by Peter Thiel, but also by Donald Trump's son-in-law. And so, you know, there's definitely been a lot of reaching out taking place here. You know, again, people trying to make the best of a bad situation. But notably, I should point out, however, that the head of Twitter, which Donald Trump has made extensive use of course, in his campaign, the head of Twitter was not invited to the meeting.
How come?
Don't know. Don't know. And in fact, I think people are speculating about that because one would think that, you know, he would have been number one on the list to invite. But in fact, he was excluded or he chose not to attend.
Why were the high tech companies so invested with the Obama administration and with the Clinton campaign? Talk about how they were. Your research, and we had you on this show, and you also did an exclusive report that was extremely prominent on Sputnik's website about the fact that Google could and seemed to be altering search terms or the algorithm for search terms, and especially for negative search terms, in a way that would favor Hillary Clinton. Of course, Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote. She got maybe 2.5 million more votes than Donald Trump. Talk about the trajectory, how this is all shaping up, and how you, now that you look back at the election, do you have any sort of second thoughts about your own research, or do you feel that the election outcome was, in fact, impacted by Google's search algorithms?
Well, we collected a tremendous amount of data before the election, and we're still in the process of analyzing it. It's going to take us a few more weeks to figure out what happened. But there's no question that at least during the summer that Google and very likely Facebook were doing things to try to shift votes to Hillary Clinton. But it appears that both of these big companies might have backed off in the weeks before the election, probably from overconfidence, probably simply believing that that she had the election locked up. So I think there are probably people kicking themselves these days in Silicon Valley because they had invested a lot of time, energy, and money promoting Hillary Clinton. And I think they may have backed off. There's some evidence, for example, that on election day, Facebook was sending out go out and vote reminders to everybody. What we thought was going to happen was that they were going to send out these reminders just to supporters of Hillary Clinton, which would have given her approximately 700,000 more votes that day. We know this from very solid research that's been done on this issue. But apparently Facebook backed off and they sent out these reminders to everyone, not just selectively to Hillary Clinton's supporters. I think this was overconfidence on the part of these companies. Maybe also some caution on the part of these companies. But as I say, I think they're kicking themselves now.
Well, a lot of conservatives had been asserting the idea that in fact, Facebook was favoring the Democrats, that it was discriminating against conservative posts. Your own research would have really, it would seem to me, struck a nerve with Google, with the idea that a company that monitors or safeguards or is seen as the steward over the internet, in other words, a benign force, might be actually involved in interfering with and trying to tamper the election outcome by the way its own algorithms were with negative searches. It would seem to me that they might have also been alarmed that people would start to get the right idea about what they were doing, and perhaps that made them back down or back off or retreat a little bit. What do you think about that?
Well, it is possible. They say we're analyzing data now, and we will know more in a few weeks. But it appears it's possible that literally just a few days after my article came out in Sputnik News, which documented the fact that over the summer, Google was suppressing negative search suggestions related to Hillary Clinton, which, by the way, would have an enormous impact on voting preferences. It appears that a few days after my article came out in Sputnik announcing this, that Google stopped this manipulation, literally just like flipping a light switch, that they just stopped doing that. And they started to show negative search suggestions for both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, which they had not been doing in the summer. So, yes, you're right. They might have said we don't want people discovering what we're doing. We don't want people discovering our manipulations. We might get in trouble as a result. And again, it appears possibly they backed off. We will know more about this. I want to be clear. We will know more about this in a few weeks because we have a lot of data that we're looking at. But as I say, these big companies had and still have enormous power to influence not just elections, but to influence people's opinions about just about everything. And they can do so legally at this point. But it could be that here and there, they're worried about, people finding out about what they're doing. And it could be that they are backing down on some of these manipulations.
Right. It seems to me that there are a couple different issues. One is the big picture, which is the outsized influence that Google or other high-tech companies that sort of function as the steward over the internet can impact even quietly, silently on political outcomes, on democratic outcomes, or in fact, how they can sort of tamper with democracy in a way that negates democracy. That's the big picture. The more narrow picture is what actually happened in the 2016 election. And as you know, Dr. Epstein, the big story in all the mainstream media is that Russia, and now we have Vladimir Putin personally, was interfering with the election in order to favor the outcome that happened, which was the election of Donald Trump. That's the big story. Of course, again, no evidence, just circumstantial evidence. We had NSA whistleblower Bill Binney, who has great technical expertise, on this show a couple days ago. And he said he doesn't believe it's a hack at all. He believes it's an inside leak. And otherwise, the NSA would not have to point to, or the CIA would not have to point to, circumstantial evidence. They could point to hard evidence, but they don't do that. But what you're saying and what you've been saying is that it's maybe we're looking in the wrong direction. Instead of looking at Russia, we could look at homegrown American high-tech companies trying to interfere with the outcome of the election. And certainly, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, 33 employees of Google and its parent company, Alphabet, donated $201 or more to Donald Trump, totaling $23,000. Clinton, on the other hand, counted 1,359 Google or Alphabet employees as donors who contributed a total of $1.6 million. Google CEO Eric Schmidt even was wearing a staff badge during the Clinton election night party. How did Google start to become so intertwined with the Obama White House, with the Clinton campaign? And why, in your opinion, did they favor Clinton so heavily?
Well, they, of course, have had a very close relationship with the Obama administration. I think they simply wanted to continue that relationship. Now they've got a kind of a problem on their hands, but they're acting as swiftly, as I mentioned. They're acting very swiftly to solve this problem and to ingratiate themselves with the new administration. In terms of donations, there's no question about the pattern. What you didn't mention the big donation, the co-founder of Facebook, Dustin Moskovitz, a few weeks before the election, donated $20 million. That's one donation, $20 million to Hillary Clinton and the Democrats. So no question about the strong investment of Silicon Valley in Clinton's presidency.
And of course, we have the frequency with which Google employees actually were constantly visiting the White House. I mean, they were there more than any other company.
Sure, about 10 times more than any comparable company. Regarding Russia, I think we're going to have to wait and see on that. Of course, President Obama has ordered an investigation, and he has also indicated that investigation has to be completed before his term ends in January 20th. So we'll have to see. If there is hard evidence might be released between now and then, and we'll have to see. This was a complicated situation, a complicated election, unprecedented in many ways. What we do know for sure is that high technology, the internet in particular, played an enormous role in this election, more so than in any other election in history. And I think we all have to look very, very carefully at that issue. You know, the spread of false news stories, biased search rankings, biased search suggestions, biased news feeds. All of this is new. And we need to look very carefully at all this because we clearly don't want this kind of high-tech chaos occurring in election after election. It really will make democracy quite meaningless.
Right. We already have a lot of money, too much money, $2.5-3 billion in the presidential election. But besides the hard money, the cash that pays for so much, without which nobody can really be a serious contender, you have the internet, which is really, as you say, Dr. Epstein, where people are getting their news, their information, also their emotions and psychological sort of orientation towards political events are shaped by not just hard news, but all kinds of inputs that come across our computer screens and our smartphones. It's really a big issue. And I want to congratulate you and remind our audience that your research isn't premised on your having favored Donald Trump, for instance, because you were, in fact, supporting Hillary Clinton. Is that right?
I thought she was the stronger candidate just because she has so much relevant experience. And I am nervous about Donald Trump, even though I actually have friends who work in his campaign and friends even within his family. I'm a little nervous about, you know, how he's going to work out given his lack of experience. So, yeah, I certainly was not trying to hurt Hillary Clinton. I thought she was would have made a superb president. But I do feel that whoever is going to win should win fairly. And that's why I spoke out. And that's why I've been doing the research that I've been doing to try to understand these new processes that are operating because of new technologies and that have an enormous impact on how people vote and on their opinions. And this is not an issue that's going to go away. It's going to become increasingly important as more and more people get their information about everything through the internet.
We're going to have to leave it there. We've been joined from San Diego by Dr. Robert Epstein. He is the senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The corporate media has gone into overdrive in the final stages of the battle for Aleppo, launching a propaganda campaign against mass killings and even genocide being carried out, they say, by the Syrian Arab Army. Are the Western governments and press outlets really the humanitarians they claim to be? We are joined by independent journalist Eva Bartlett. She's in California right now. She's been touring. She was just in Syria. Welcome, Eva.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Eva, last week at a press conference, you said, quote, people's support of their government, meaning the government in Syria, is absolutely true. And on that note, what you hear in the corporate media, and I will name them, BBC, Guardian, The New York Times, etc., on Aleppo is also the opposite of reality. Those are your words speaking at a press conference after you returned from Syria. Tell us about the mainstream media campaign and how your own experiences in Syria have contradicted their narrative, their presentation.
Yes, well, I mean, with regards to the support the Syrian people overwhelmingly have for their government, this is omitted from corporate media reporting, or if it's mentioned at all, it's made out to be minimal support, or the people are made to be supporting their president for reasons they don't quite understand, and that's not true. People have varied reasons for supporting their president. The point I was trying to make is that you will, if you actually go to Syria and you talk with people, they will lay out the reasons for supporting the president, whether it's they see him as a point of unity in bringing peace and stability to the country, or more frequently, they see him as not the issue in Syria. They're very well informed. They're very well aware that what's happening in Syria is not a revolution and is a mixture of foreign countries attacking their own safety and security and killing their people. So I made that point, and I also went on to mention that, you know, a lot of the sources that corporate media and some human rights institutions cite as credible sources on the ground in, say, Aleppo, they don't exist or they're not credible themselves. And so, for example, the routine citing of unnamed activists itself is not credible because you can essentially say anything you want and say an unnamed activist said that. And where is the credibility in that? Routinely citing the so-called Syrian civil defense or what's known as the White Helmets is also not credible when you consider their foundation, which was in 2013 funded and supported by the US, UK, and other NATO allied states. and you consider the fact that they are only present in al-Nusra, al-Qaeda areas, and while they purport to be rescuing Syrian civilians, testimonies coming out of eastern areas of Aleppo now, of the areas that have been almost fully liberated by the Syrian Arab Army, the people there, if they're asked about the White Helmets, they've either not heard of them, or just yesterday I was seeing some reports and people were saying they were talking about actual people that were wearing White Helmets. Again, they're not widely known, but the people that had encountered them did not have favorable things to say about them. And I would refer to my colleague Vanessa Bealey, who was on the ground in Aleppo and took some of these testimonies. And one woman was saying some pretty horrific things about how she was treated by a member of this group that purports to be rescuing these people. But the point I was trying to make also is that other sources like the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights is itself not based in Syria, and it's basically a one-man organization who himself relies on the testimonies of unnamed activists or the White Helmets. The United Nations, just on December 13th, their High Commissioner for Human Rights released a statement accusing the Syrian Arab Army of slaughtering civilians in eastern Aleppo. And this is from the United Nations itself, and they themselves did not name any of their sources. And we're supposed to take this as credible. These are the types of reports, whether from the United Nations, human rights groups, or corporate media, that we've been assaulted with for years. And they continue to ignore the voices of the people in Syria, particularly now where we have access to the people who've been living under terrorist rule for years and who are saying completely the opposite of what we've been told. They are by and large not blaming the Syrian Arab Army. They are blaming the terrorists for a variety of crimes. And their voices are the ones that we need to be hearing, not these ones that are citing unnamed sources.
Eva Bartlett, you just came back from Syria. Talk about how many times you've been to Syria. Where were you in the most recent trip? And have you been to Aleppo? And when you were in Aleppo, if you were, talk about what you saw, what you witnessed, what you observed.
I've been to Syria 6 times since April 2014. I've been throughout areas including Homs, Latakia, Maalula, Tartus, Sueda, obviously Damascus and its environs. And I've been to Aleppo 4 times. So, I mean, Homs, I can talk about Homs because there are parallels between what's happening now in Aleppo and what happened in Homs, and I'll just briefly touch upon that. Homs was once dubbed the capital of the revolution, but when it was cleared of terrorist factions, the people that remained in Homs in the old city were speaking truths that we're hearing from people in eastern Aleppo now, the same stories of being terrorized by these different militant factions who stole food and basically terrorized the people and killed the people who didn't march to their orders. In Aleppo, I went 4 times, once in July, once in August, and twice in November. During those times, I met with a variety of people on the ground. I spoke Arabic with them, asked them what they want, what they feel, what they're enduring. They told me of the years that they'd been enduring terrorism by these different militant factions who for periods were able to besiege the over 1.5 million people in greater Aleppo. By cutting off the main road that led to Aleppo, meaning that these people were being deprived of the goods that are coming in daily from this road. So they were being deprived of food and medicine. They were also for years deprived of electricity and water because the power plant and the water pumping stations lay in areas controlled by terrorists. So on top of that, they've also been enduring on a daily basis a variety of bombing attacks, whether gas canister bombs, conventional bombs like Grad missiles, mortars, explosive bullets, and snipings. And I experienced a degree of those things myself while in Aleppo on various trips, including having mortars land within 500 meters of where I was on a few different occasions. On my trips in November, I was able to visit a humanitarian corridor, both the corridors of Bustan al-Qasr, which people will be hearing about in the news recently, and the Castello Road crossing. And this was on a day which these two crossings and 6 others were opened to enable, to allow civilians and militants to exit these areas of eastern Aleppo that are now liberated but were then occupied. And on that day, November 4th, Castello Road crossing was shelled twice at very close range while I was there and 5 more times after I'd left. This was not the first time such humanitarian corridors were shelled, and the intent clearly was that the terrorists inside did not wish for the people that were inside who wanted to leave to be able to leave. During my second visit in November, so my 4th visit to Aleppo, I met with two different families from eastern areas of Aleppo who had managed to escape. One family had fled in late October and said they'd tried to flee twice before, but they were stopped by the militants in that area, which was El Halok, near Bustan and Fasha in eastern areas of Aleppo. And the other family had tried to flee four times prior, and they were in an area near the Al-Bab, Tariq Al-Bab, to the east of Aleppo. And their points were the same as what we're hearing now from journalists on the ground in Aleppo, the same things about being terrorized, being prevented from leaving, being imposed upon them, the warped Wahhabi version of Islam, that the terrorists had control of food and medicine. All the things that the corporate media has accused the Syrian government of, people who've actually been able to flee are saying the opposite, that it was in fact the terrorist factions who were committing these atrocities.
Eva Bartlett, I've talked to numerous people who are have either been to Aleppo or from Aleppo, are Syrians who grew up in other cities. The argument that they make, these are, of course, people who are not supporting the armed opposition groups, is that the people in Aleppo never really engaged in any kind of armed uprising or mass uprising against the Assad government. Undoubtedly, in Aleppo, like in all cities, even people who would now favor the government compared to what it's, you know, the alternative of living under Al-Qaeda or ISIS, people have grievances. They have political differences of opinion. That would be understandable. But that said, that there wasn't really a massive uprising of any type in Aleppo, that this was, in fact, an invasion of Aleppo by armed fighters, many of them foreigners, some Syrians, but from other parts of Syria, who came into East Aleppo in 2012. When you were in West Aleppo, what was that like? And were you getting from people in West Aleppo, obviously they're close by, they're actually neighbors to people in East Aleppo. Was that the sort of narrative that you were getting from ordinary people? In other words, I'm not talking about government officials, but when you interacted with the population in West Aleppo?
Absolutely. And I'll also just note that even when I interacted with Syrians in, say, Latakia, I met internally displaced Syrians who had fled eastern areas of Aleppo in around that time, either late 2012 or early 2013, precisely due to the presence of these terrorist factions who invaded their neighborhoods. And they fled to other areas like, for example, Latakia or Jeble to restart their lives. So they fled to government-secured areas. But when I was in West Aleppo, I had many opportunities to converse with people in shops, on the street, around the city, from doctors to average civilians. And they did say, and in fact, I met people at another internally displaced people center, and I also visited the Aleppo University, whose residences, 16 of the 20 residences, are housing people from other areas of Aleppo that then were occupied by terrorists. And they did say that they fled to these areas because they wanted security. They did not welcome the presence of these terrorists. They did have loved ones that were in the areas that were until recently occupied by terrorist factions. And they were, you know, they were obviously in touch with their loved ones and worried about their fate because, you know, many people were saying, my loved ones are in East Aleppo and they can't get access to food because of the terrorists. When I was in Greater Aleppo, I also visited hospitals that the terrorists have bombed, including the Dabit Maternity Hospital. And, you know, with all the hype in the media about the Syrian government and the Russian government supposedly bombing hospitals in eastern Aleppo, you'd think that the bombing of a woman's hospital and the killing of three women inside would have made would have been, you know, something reported in the media and that the UN would have condemned, but it got very little coverage. And in fact, even the December 2013 bombing of the Kindi Hospital, which was the greatest, largest and you know, most well-equipped cancer treatment hospital in the Middle East, and it was truck-bombed by al-Nusra, and this got very little condemnation. I spoke with the former director of that hospital, and he told me he implored officials of the different international organizations, when it was occupied by terrorists, he implored them to do something, and when it was bombed by terrorists, he waited for their condemnation from these different officials, and he got none. And in fact, in recent months, the media, which has been lying so greatly about Aleppo, even took, it was Fox News or CNN, even used a photo of the Kindi Hospital and claimed this was in eastern Aleppo and that the so-called Syrian government had bombed it. So the media and the United Nations itself have been lying about the situation in Aleppo. What they've said does not mirror what the people on the streets in western or greater Aleppo have said. And I just want to make one other point. The United Nations for years has been maintaining that there have been 250,000 civilians in eastern Aleppo. But now almost every pocket of Aleppo that was occupied by terrorist factions has been liberated. And out of those areas, at most, there's come maybe 100,000 people. So where are the other 150,000? Are we really truly to believe they're standing on top of one another in this small 2-square-mile area that still has a few remaining militant factions?
Yeah, we're talking with Canadian independent journalist Eva Bartlett, who's just back from Syria. She's been to Syria 6 times, been to Aleppo 4 times. We're talking about the difference, the profound difference in the media coverage coming from the United States mainstream media, which functions as an echo chamber for the U.S. government, and by the U.N. media, again, seeming to function as an echo chamber for the U.S. government policy. And the media, say, in the Middle East, and particularly in Syria, where people are seen celebrating in jubilation by the fact and over the fact that East Aleppo has been liberated from right-wing terrorist organizations like al-Qaeda. You mentioned, Eva Bartlett, about the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. What people should also know is that the commissioner is Prince Zayed bin Raad. He is a part of the Jordanian royal family. Of course, Jordan has played a key role working as the place, as the location for a CIA-coordinated system for the past 5 years in Syria, coordinating the funneling of arms and fighters and money to armed opposition groups inside of Syria. In other words, he has a conflict of interest so major that it's impossible to think that the media would quote him and use him as the UN voice, except for the fact that he shares the same political agenda. Eva Bartlett, in our last 2 minutes, yesterday, John Kerry, Secretary of State, held a press briefing about what's going on in Aleppo. Again, U.S. officials seem crestfallen by the fact that East Aleppo, occupied by al-Qaeda, has now been or is virtually completely liberated from these kind of forces. But he was explaining that the political efforts for a resolution, a negotiated settlement, rather than the continuance of the war, which both the United States and Russia and the Syrian government agreed to, fell apart. And one of the things he cited was that on September 17th, shortly after the ceasefire was to take place, the United States military actually bombed Syrian Arab Army positions in areas that they had held for a long time in Deir al-Zor. And those areas were then occupied by ISIS, and the Syrian government and perhaps the Russian government interpreted it as a direct sabotage by the Pentagon of any efforts either by the State Department or any other entity to actually have a negotiated resolution. All that is important information, I think, because when we talk about the onus for why bleeding is continuing, whatever is going on, whatever the media accounts you read, there's this ocean of human suffering in Syria. The onus is, I'd say, pretty much on the Pentagon, because the Pentagon has refused any and all offers, genuine offers by the Syrian government or the Russian government or both, to come up with a resolution. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. I mean, the attack that you referred to, it went on for nearly 1 hour, and at least 83 Syrian soldiers were killed, and ISIS did take over the position. And this is not the first time that the U.S. has enabled ISIS to take over positions in Syria. At the same time, the Syrians and the Russians have shown good faith in adhering to these ceasefires that only they adhere to, and none of the client state terrorists that the U.S. backs themselves adhere to. And you know, with regard to that September ceasefire, 20 main factions, militant factions, came out and said, we're not taking part in the ceasefire. So, I mean, the U.S. can't even control these so-called moderate rebels that it funds and supports.
Yeah, so we're going to have to leave it there, Eva Bartlett. Was the 20 armed groups said they wouldn't participate in? Ash Carter and the Pentagon made it quite clear that they were opposed to any sort of resolution, even though President Obama had at least tepidly signed off onto the State Department proposal to go forward with a ceasefire. We are out of time. We've been joined by Canadian journalist, independent journalist Eva Bartlett. She's just back from Syria, a completely different narrative from that which you receive in the Western mainstream media. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Despite international and domestic condemnation, the far-right government led by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu seems determined to push ahead with a law that would legalize Israeli settlements built on private Palestinian land. We are joined from Washington, D.C. to discuss this development by activist and writer Miko Peled. He is the author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Welcome, Miko.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Thanks for joining. Tell us about the settlement legalization bill that is being considered. Legendary Palestinian leader and Palestinian Legislative Council member Mustafa Barghouti told the Jerusalem Post that the bill, quote, is a declaration of war on the Palestinian people and on peace, and an act that attempts to assassinate the possibility of a two-state solution. Talk about what the settlement legalization bill is.
Well, I think, to be honest, it's really nothing more than a formality. In terms of the reality on the ground, in terms of the way Israelis on the street and the Israeli authority view the settlements, this is, they're legal, they're there to stay, and nobody really cares what the rest of the world thinks. So really, it's nothing more than a formality. The legalization de facto of Israeli settlements all over Palestine, and I'm not only talking about the West Bank, I'm talking about the entire country, all of Palestine, which many people recognize as Israel, is a process, is something that's been going on for more than seven decades. So there's really nothing new or nothing significant about this beyond the fact that they're adding a little bit of a formality, and they're pushing the boundaries, if you will, in that the most of the world doesn't like to admit that this is only a formality. They try to pretend as though the settlements that Israel builds in the West Bank are somehow illegal and should not be recognized. But the fact is they get their water supply, their electricity supply, the police. I mean, everything that a normal city and a normal town gets anywhere in Israel, they get just like everybody else. So it's a formality. And in a way, they're pushing the limits, I think, now, because I think they can, with the President Trump, they can get away with it and perhaps get a little more recognition, international recognition, for this process of the colonizing of Palestine and the oppression of Palestinians.
So will it pass? Will it become the law?
It's hard to say, but I find it hard to believe that it won't. I mean, the government has a very clear majority in the Knesset, in the parliament. The majority of the people in the parliament, vast majority, agree to this. I don't think they see this as anything unique or different. If there is some argument about this, it's how the world will perceive it and how the world will see this, and will it help us with the nations of the world, us meaning Israel, if it will help Israel with the nations of the world and that sort of thing. But in terms of the actual act of recognizing the legitimacy of these settlements, there's really no debate, no serious argument among Israeli politicians or among Israelis on the street.
Right. So de facto, this exists already. But sometimes even the legalization or formalization of what's been accepted as a de facto reality has a triggering factor, either in perception or actions by some of the actors involved in a historical process, especially a complex one. That's why I'm wanted to get more reaction from you, Miko, about whether, if it should become law, whether it will have or could have, even though it's not a change in terms of the reality on the ground, whether it could catalyze other developments. The UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process said, if adopted, it will, this is a quote, if adopted, it will have far-reaching legal consequences for Israel across the occupied West Bank and will greatly diminish the prospect of Arab-Israeli peace, which obviously no one really believes is about to happen.
Exactly.
But in other words, if it's passed, does it have any significance?
I don't think it does. I think everybody's very happy to live with this, within this lie that somehow, first of all, that somehow there's a difference between settlements in the West Bank and settlements in other parts of the country. Because in reality, all Israel is occupied Palestine, and all Israeli towns and cities are illegal settlements that were built on stolen Palestinian land. Now, Israel extended that reality into the West Bank when it occupied the West Bank almost 50 years ago. And still, the world likes to pretend that there's a somehow legitimate part of Israel and an illegitimate in an illegitimate part of Israel. At the same time, Israel gets away with building these settlements, and they've been building, you know, many of them. Many of them are big cities, of course, in the West Bank. But somehow there are no consequences to the fact that Israel does it, even though it contravenes, you know, international law, U.S. law, and so on and so forth. And I'm sure everybody knows Israel has just received an agreement or a promise to get $38 billion over the next 10 years. And this is as this is happening. So I don't think there's any significance, whether it's legalized, whether it's considered legal or not considered legal, if it passes or doesn't pass, will make absolutely no difference in the life of Palestinians. It will not make any difference to the fact that Palestinians are denied their right to have water, for example. They're denied to have their rights, period, that Palestinians are, thousands of Palestinians are in Israeli prisons. This kind of, you know, this pretense, if you will, has no significance whatsoever. The reality is that this is something that's been taking place for 7 decades all over Palestine. And that is, I think, what needs to be recognized, and that's what needs to be discussed. Israel passes laws that contravene international law all the time. It's legal to kill Palestinians. It's legal to arrest Palestinians and torture them. It's legal to arrest and torture Palestinian children. It's legal to destroy Palestinian towns and bomb Palestinian homes and to murder Palestinians in Gaza. So the fact that Israel makes something legal doesn't make it legal. It just makes it legal in the eyes of a small group of people who like to live within this pretense. But I don't think it's going to make any significance. It's not going to be significant one way or the other to Palestinians on the ground who are the victims of this process.
We're speaking with activist and writer Miko Peled. He's the author of The General Stun, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Talk about your book and what that journey was.
Well, the journey in a way was exactly the what I was describing now, moving from this living within this myth, within this reality, which is a false reality that pretends that there's somehow a legitimate part of Israel of occupied Palestine, which is Israel, and there's an illegitimate part of occupied Palestine of Israel, which is the occupied West Bank, and then realizing that the entire country is occupied Palestine, it's all illegitimate. In other words, there is no legitimacy to a Jewish state in Palestine anywhere, that all Israeli towns and cities, even if, you know, including Tel Aviv and all these other very Jewish Israeli towns, are illegitimate. They were built on stolen Palestinian land. We know that there are 5 million or so Palestinians living in refugee camps because of that, and it's been going on for 7 decades. So my journey was from living in that sphere, very privileged sphere, very clean, very safe, very, very Jewish and in a way white sphere, into the sphere of the oppressed, into the sphere of the other who was denied the privileges that I was given and who was the victim of the reality that was created in order to provide me and people like myself these privileges. And having gone through that journey, and again, geographically, it's a very short journey because Palestinian communities are quite often across the street from Israeli communities. And still the segregation, deprivation, and the racism is very deep. And realizing that there is an entire other reality that exists across the street practically, or maybe 10-minute drive from where I was born and raised and where I lived, that is and then trying to make sense of it all and trying to understand how can this be legitimate? How can this be okay that one part of the population lives in one way and under certain laws and another part of the population lives under an entirely different reality and completely different laws? So that is really the gist of my journey. You know, it's from the sphere of the privileged to the sphere of those who paid the price so that I would have the privilege and realizing there's no justification and there's no legitimacy to this. And we need to completely undo this reality and provide the same rights to everyone.
How did it happen? I mean, what caused the change for you? How did your family react? And do other Israelis or many Israelis share your views?
Very, very, very few Israelis share my views. The discussion about a non-Zionist or discussion that goes beyond the boundaries of the legitimacy of the state of Israel doesn't exist in Israel. The Israelis don't want to have that conversation. And there are very few Israelis who are willing to engage in it. And very few Israelis who are willing to take the journey from their very safe and clean and Jewish sphere into the sphere of the Palestinians. Because like in all, you know, settler colonial societies, the myth is that the other is dangerous, irrational, terrorists prone to violence. And so if we step into their sphere, we will be killed. So Israelis don't do that. And of course, there are soldiers and walls and big signs that warn Israelis not to do that. So very few Israelis do that. And the conversation, this conversation really is not found within Israel, except in the very, very small margins, you know, where the very radical progressive, between a few radical progressives. You know, what drove me into this is what drives, you know, what normally drives us to embrace change is usually a tragedy. And in my case, it was the same thing. My sister's little girl was killed in a suicide attack. That drove me to engage, to look beyond my sphere and to try to understand what exists among Palestinians. It drove me to meet Palestinians, which really was the turning point, because once I met Palestinians, I began hearing the Palestinian narrative and understanding the reality that exists there. And then traveling into, again, taking that journey, that very short geographically, but very big journey mentally, emotionally into that sphere, I began to see what really is happening, and to realize that the state of Israel is not a liberal democracy. It's not the only democracy in the Middle East. In fact, it's not a democracy at all. It's a racist apartheid state that provides exclusive right to Jewish people at the expense of the native population, who are the Palestinians, and particularly the Palestinians who live in refugee camps, you know, all around Palestine and even within Palestine, some 5 or so million of them, who I believe have the right to return and should be allowed to return to their homes. And that is really the key to if we really care about justice in Palestine, these are the keys. So that was kind of, that journey is what allowed me to realize what I realize today.
And what about your family?
My family, you know, different people, different parts of my family share different parts of this, some more, some less. You know, it's just the reality that, you know, we only accept what we understand. We can only accept the reality as we see it. So different people within my family see it, you know, in different ways. Let's just put it that way.
You know, when I was growing up in the United States, in Western New York, in Rochester, New York, and in, for a big part of it, in a suburb of Rochester, which was an all-white suburb, the white population had no contact at all, no connection with the black community, which was, again, like a mile or 2 miles away. And the level of racism as a child that I could see firsthand from my classmates or their parents, it was very, very palpable. I mean, it was comprehensive. It was across the board. Even though the United States had passed the 64 Civil Rights Act, desegregating public transportation in the South, in fact, the United States, which was formed as a settler nation, also had this kind of pervasive racism. And again, the separation and segregation of communities made that all possible. In your work here, Miko, as you're talking about how this experience has played out in Israel, which you describe as an apartheid state, as a racist state, in essence, I believe, when you're encountering Jewish Americans who maybe historically looked upon Israel or maybe still do with sympathy, there must be, it seems obvious to me that there's a growing disenchantment with how things are going in Israel. How do you see it playing out within the Jewish community here in the United States?
First of all, I don't really accept the premise that there's such a thing as a Jewish community. I think there are many communities that happen to be Jewish. And so that depends who you're talking to. If we talk about the mainstream, you know, the big synagogues and so forth, then obviously they are very, very, they're entrenched in the Zionist narrative and they support the state of Israel. And as you drive in towns everywhere, you see these big signs, big banners outside the synagogue saying, "We support Israel, we love Israel." And of course, the Israeli flag is everywhere. So there's really no conversation between me and them. I mean, if anything, they might show up to my lectures with a banner or come to ask, you know, nasty questions. So there's really no conversation there. On the other hand, when I visit, you know, campuses, when I speak, I'm invited to speak at campuses by Students for Justice in Palestine, very often a large number of the students who are members of the Students for Justice in Palestine happen to be Jewish. So there's a growing number of Jewish people who are completely who completely understand the reality, who completely understand that there's justification to the Palestinian resistance and so forth. So, you know, it all depends who you're talking to and which Jewish community. And then, of course, you've got the ultra-Orthodox Neturei Karta group who have always been anti-Zionist and continue to be anti-Zionist. And I would say they got it right from the beginning. You know, so it depends which Jews we're talking about and the conversation and that kind of determines what kind of conversation we have. And it's funny you mentioned Rochester, because I was in Rochester just a month or so ago. In fact, I was there twice, and I went for a run, and my hotel was right next to the university. And as I went for a run, I ran right through the Black Ghetto. And the difference between the clean, paved, beautiful sidewalks where my hotel was and that were leading into the university, and the potholes and the boarded houses and the people, you know, kind of standing at street corners, blacks, of course, reminded me a lot of the difference between, you know, driving or walking through Jewish towns and Jewish neighborhoods and then crossing over to a Palestinian neighborhood. You know, the racism is very deep, the segregation is very deep, and exists, obviously, to this day.
Miko, I want to ask you in our last 2 minutes, going back to what we referred to or what you mentioned about Israel has just signed a deal to get $38 billion in U.S. military aid over multiple years. Ash Carter went to Israel for the ceremonies with the delivery of the first F-35 jets, which are officially priced at $100 million, but will really be about $200 million. Israel's getting 100 of them. So in a way, well, Netanyahu said about it, he says, with the F-35s, quote, our long arm has now become longer and mightier. But really what's happening in a lot of ways is that the aid to Israel is just being completely recycled back to U.S. arms manufacturers. In other words, it's not really in some ways aid for Israel as much as a subsidy for the military-industrial complex, and then the intertangling of that with the defense of Israel. I mean, that's all tied in as part of institutional power here in Washington.
Of course, that's how it's always been. I mean, the large portions of the aid to Israel has always really been just money laundering, government money laundering going into the weapons manufacturers. That's how it's always been, and it continues to be this way. And I think it's important to note that this every penny of this $38 billion and every piece of weaponry, whether it's a bullet or it's this monstrous F-35, which just landed, the first one of which just landed in Israel, every bit of that is going to deprive Palestinians' rights, kill Palestinians, allow this monstrosity that exists in Palestine, which is the state of Israel, to continue to oppress and kill and arrest and detain and torture Palestinians. And I think it's imperative that Americans realize that their tax dollars are going for this purpose, that every American, unless they stand up and clearly voice their opposition to this, is complicit in this genocide that is taking place in Palestine. And again, this monstrosity of a plane, this F-35, is going to contribute to that. And I don't think Americans fully realize just how complicit they are, once again, I should say, in the crime of genocide against the people that have done nothing to Americans, or the Palestinian people. And unless we stand up, all Americans stand up and actually voice their opposition and act and speak to their members of Congress and speak to their neighbors and make sure that all this legislation against boycott, divestment, and sanctions is opposed, then they are actually complicit in some very serious crimes.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We're completely out of time. We've been talking with activist and writer Miko Peled, the author of The General Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. We'll be back. Be sure to check out our Facebook page, Loud and Clear, with Brian Becker for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.